Chris Boyd. Up next on Think, if the word meme makes you think about cute cat photos and GIFs pulled from movies, well, you're not wrong. But you may be misunderstanding the power of these bite-sized bits of culture. We'll spend the hour with technologist and artist Anshel Mina. She's traced the role of memes in spreading social and political movements in the U.S. and in China, where citizens work around strict censorship of words using pictures that look innocent but carry great meaning for those in the know. Our conversation starts after a short break. Day you spend time online, you're likely to encounter memes, little units of content that spread virally through a culture, often in the form of digital images, GIFs, and short videos. There are plenty of frivolous examples out there. Think those caption pictures of Grumpy Cat that we laugh at, or tiny movie clips used as comments on your social media posts. But memes are also used all the time in service to more serious ideas. And as the ultimate interactive art form, memes are a vital tool of expression for people living under repressive regimes. From KERA in Dallas, this is Think. I'm Chris Boyd. As a technologist, researcher, and artist, Anshel Mina has been fascinated by the ways people have found to make and remake memes to express themselves. And she's discovered that their impact is not limited to the online world. She writes about this in her new book, Memes to Movements: How the World's Most Viral Media is Changing Social Protest and Power. She joins us from the studios of NPR in New York to talk about it. An, welcome to Think.
Hi, Chris. Thank you so much for having me here.
What is a meme exactly? What counts?
A meme is, for the book, I interviewed Amanda Brennan. She's a great title, Tumblr Meme Librarian. Hmm. And I think she has a really great definition. It's pieces of content that travel from person to person and change along the way. And I think that that latter part, the change part, is a really important aspect of this that a lot of meme scholars will say is different from virality, where a viral thing is shared widely, whereas memes are also changed and remixed.
Yeah, you call internet memes an invitation because we can create our own iteration of whatever it is we've received.
That's right. They are an invitation to play, to contribute, and in many ways reflect a new type of kind of relationship with media that is in some ways the old way, which is that we can shape it and spread it in the ways that we find interesting.
So memes sometimes will start as digital objects and then take on a life in physical objects and real world activity. How does that typically play out?
So in the context of politics, I think if you think about the Women's March, and I think there's another Women's March coming up this weekend, the first one in D.C., it was so striking because people had all kinds of memes on their signs. And there are two ways when I would chat with people. Some of them would just print them out and just literally find an interesting meme, print it out, and put it onto a sign. Others would reference it. They put hashtags on their signs and use those hashtags as kind of an indicator that they were there for a certain reason, like hashtag Women's March. And also just the physicality of it, like through knitting. The pussy hats were in many ways a sort of meme that came to life through knitting circles, and then people taking selfies and posting them online to share back with the people who made them the hats.
I had noticed while doing holiday shopping that there were llamas everywhere, llama toys, llama stickers, llama t-shirts.
Yes, yes.
I had wondered why until I read your account of what's called the grass mud horse. Tell us about that.
Yes. So the grass mud horse is a profane pun in China, and it is a symbol of internet resistance to internet censorship, and it's in Chinese it's pronounced Cao Ni Ma, and Chinese is a tonal language. You change the tone and you change the meaning, and this allows Chinese people to make all variety of puns. The grass mud horse in Chinese sounds a lot like the Chinese phrase for F your mother.
Oh, goodness.
And it's short. Yeah, it's short for, it's short for F internet censorship. And it's part of this larger pantheon of meme creatures. Its mortal enemy is the river crab. In Chinese, the word for river crab sounds a lot like the word for harmony. The policy that was in place back when this meme was popular, especially around 2010, 2011, was a harmonious internet. And that harmonious internet was a stand-in for a censored internet. And so the grass mud horse and the river crab are kind of in epic battle for free expression on the internet.
That's just extraordinary context and content within what might appear like very simple images, even just line drawings.
Yes, yeah. Absolutely. And it takes the form of an alpaca llama, you know, and it looks like a harmless image. And in so many ways is a harmless and cute image of llamas. And people are just repurposing existing funny pictures of llamas. But it's that coded quality of it, the fact that it's difficult for you to understand, difficult for someone from the outside to understand all the different references, that made it a very effective vehicle for evading censorship and, in fact, talking about censorship and how it operates in China.
Yeah, so talk about that. How does censorship work in China? You explain that there are like automatic, I guess there's software that sort of looks around for objectionable mm-hmm. words, and then there are people that are responsible for looking at this content.
That's right. It's kind of a mix of human and algorithmic systems. A combination of like keyword search algorithms, kind of sentiment analysis, but then also just lots and lots of people, rumors in thousands, even tens of thousands of people per platform. Who will go through the content, and they might have lists of sensitive words or sensitive content to censor and remove. And then there's also image search recognition as well. And so it's this combination of different factors, both humans and machines, that allows for censorship to extend in a more networked way across, you know, all variety of different types of posts online.
But I guess some of these images, if I post a grass mud horse or I post a crab, I have plausible deniability, right?
There's a little bit of that. That's absolutely right. It's difficult to tell at a glance if someone is posting about a llama or if they're posting the grass mud horse. And so it becomes a kind of kind of secret code. It becomes a kind of in-group message to people who know and understand the code that you are standing against censorship. But for the censors, it just makes it much more difficult to figure out what's going on.
So in a country like the U.S. with a free and open internet, I can just Google if I don't understand what a symbol that I'm seeing everywhere means. How do the messages of what these symbols actually mean spread in a place like China?
The messages will often spread, historically, sometimes through private messaging apps or offline conversation. And I think the role of the offline is really kind of under-discussed with regards to the internet. Mm. You talk to young people when I was living in China, they would share the secret message, right, with each other, and they kind of riff off of it. Everyone knows, the pun is immediately obvious for a native speaker, but its kind of embedded meaning takes a little bit more time. And also amongst embedded groups, not everything is censored. The censorship systems are not perfect. And so especially back 2010, 2011, it was possible to have these conversations to create this kind of fictive world of the river crab, the grass mud horse engaged in battle and have a conversation in a kind of very limited way. And so that's the other thing about the Chinese internet that's important to understand, is that people can and do have political conversations. It's just that the shape of the range of it can be limited and kind of minimized through censorship. But it's not completely eliminated all the time.
All right. I want to talk about two movements that would seem to have had nothing to do with one another. How did Black Lives Matter and the Umbrella Movement in Hong Kong reference and inspire one another?
Well, it was interesting because it was that same summer of 2014 that you saw this emergence, right? And this is the opening kind of story of the book is you have hashtag Black Lives Matter. You had hashtag Umbrella Movement in Hong Kong. I think for folks in the U.S., the Umbrella Movement is a movement for universal suffrage in Hong Kong. It's a territory in the People's Republic of China, but it operates under a more free system, freedom of assembly, freedom of press, but there is a kind of limited representation in government. And so people were pushing for more representation. And it was interesting because it was that same summer that you had two hashtags, both of them represented chants. Hashtag Black Lives Matter became a chant on the streets. In Hong Kong, there was a hashtag in Cantonese that meant I want true universal suffrage. And that also became a chant. These hashtags appeared on signs. People used selfies to project the fact that they were at the protest or to show that they were engaging in the space, but also to project online. And they both had kind of mimetic performances. Black Lives Matter had the hashtag hands up, don't shoot. And interestingly, in Hong Kong, people were also raising their hands in protest. And the initial impression from journalists was, oh, wow, they're being influenced by this kind of global protest symbology. But as it turns out, it was a coincidence. But the influence, I think, was the fact that they were both trying to engage, shape narratives, and drive attention through the affordances of the same sort of digital media, regardless of where you are in the world.
Explain how the umbrella came to symbolize that fight for universal suffrage in Hong Kong.
Well, the umbrella, it's an interesting symbol, and it's, the first symbol that people were using was a yellow kind of ribbon that they would wear for the push for suffrage. And then as the protest gathered, it took on a kind of Occupy quality. It was one of the original names for the gathering was Occupy Central with Love and Peace, and it's a central district of Hong Kong. It's sort of like Wall Street in New York. And when the police came to try to disperse the protests, they used pepper spray and tear gas. And Hong Kong being especially a subtropical city, everyone carries umbrellas anyway. And so they lifted up their umbrellas to resist the pepper spray. They're a little less effective with tear gas. But either way, the stunning image of all these young people holding up umbrellas became kind of a global icon. And so it was dubbed the umbrella movement. And the umbrella stood in as a symbol. It was then mashed up with the yellow ribbons. And so ultimately, it was the yellow umbrella that came to stand in for suffrage, and particularly the context of Hong Kong.
And months into the demonstrations in Ferguson, Missouri, there was a rainy day.
That's right. That's right. And I think what was interesting, I was looking at some of the tweets, because again, there was a kind of international discourse about both of these movements. And so some of the folks at the protests took out the umbrellas. And there's one tweet I saw that said, hey, thanks, Hong Kong, for the idea, sending solidarity. And so these were little moments of solidarity and kind of volleying messages back and forth. But it speaks to this kind of global recognition of the role of the internet and the fact that people are sharing symbologies, developing symbols and narratives through digital culture.
It's worth talking about the fact that, a lot of people think meme and they think it's like some kind of dumb picture or humor, but a lot of memes contain jokes that carry serious messages within them.
That's absolutely right. That's absolutely right. And that silliness, I think what's so interesting about this moment in meme culture is this recognition that the silliness is often the place where we learn to play, we learn to engage with media, and that boundary between the silly and the serious is really quite blurry and literally fuzzy. We were talking about cat memes. I'm remembering when I was in London for the referendum on Brexit, and a lot of people were tweeting hashtag cats against Brexit and literally posting pictures of their cats and saying they were against Brexit. There was also hashtag cats for Brexit. And then when people went to the polls, they used hashtag dogs at polling stations. And so it's interesting, right? So the thing we think of as silly was embedded with the very serious issues of the day.
This is Think. I'm Chris Boyd. Another thing that comes up in the book is, a lot of people who are listening probably associate cats and dogs. They are the internet meme animals. But in many parts of the world, there are goat memes.
Yes, goat memes. Goat memes are the goat. They are, what's interesting is as the internet, I think we're getting close to the point where more than 50% of people in the world are coming online. And not everybody likes cats. Not most cultures. Many cultures don't have cats as pets. And what you find more commonly in rural societies is goat memes. And so you've got goats, and then as a result, then you have goat memes. And so for the Civic Beat, it's a research collective I co-founded with Jason Lee, we developed a map for the Museum of the Moving Image and invited internet culture researchers to submit kind of their prototypical animal for their internet, whether that was northeastern Brazil, Uganda, Bangladesh. It was all goats.
My guest is technologist, researcher, and artist Anshao Mina. Her book is called Memes to Movements: How the World's Most Viral Media is Changing Social Protest and Power. You can join the conversation at 800-933-5372. You can email think@kera.org, or you can call us 1-800-933-5372. This is Think. I'm Chris Boyd, speaking this hour with Anshao Mina. She's a technologist, researcher, and artist, and author of the new book Memes to Movements: How the World's Most Viral Media is Changing Social Protest and Power. You can join the conversation at 800-933-5372 or email think@kera.org. I think it's so interesting that Richard Dawkins coined this term memes in the late 70s, back before, you know, anybody, any sort of regular person was regularly communicating on the internet. How was that term linked to the way memes actually work on the internet? How long did that take?
Well, it seems that, you know, I think one thing is that, so the Dawkins sense of the meme, right, is he was looking for a word for like a cultural unit. That's a simplest summation of it, and was kind of inspired by the language of genetics and the idea that culture might travel like genes through human society. And the use of the word meme in the context of the internet, it seems to have popped up with Usenet forums, with internet like kind of boards, and was used in that kind of Dawkins sense, was a thing or a phrase that was shared around and circulated. But scholar Lee Moore Schiffman has kind of made the argument that we should really think of internet memes as a sort of different word, a different phenomenon, because it's so focused on this notion of remix, this notion of media, and the Dawkins sense included all types of human practices. But internet memes are very much about digital content, and in the book I talk about how they spread offline. But in so many ways, it's that word, that meaning has evolved like a meme over the past few years.
You write about the fact that memes that target profile pictures or that use people's profile pictures can carry a particular weight because in the digital age, our choice of a profile image makes a really strong statement about what we think about ourselves.
That's right. Like if you think about like historically how people would wear pins on their, you know, on their shirts or backpacks, and we still do. People use bumper stickers. This was, you know, the primary vehicle literally by which you get around the world. And so now the profile picture is associated with every post you make. And so it's very much a projection of who you are. And people spend lots of time figuring out what is the profile picture that will represent who I am. And so what's interesting was, for instance, with the marriage equality movement in the United States, how people would then add like the rainbow flag overlay to their pictures. And so this allowed them to project and say, this is a value, this is a value I have. Whereas in the physical world, you might have hung a rainbow flag. In the digital world, the profile picture, in many ways, it acts in that same kind of way, telling everybody, you know, what you stand for.
What is a performative meme?
Oh, goodness. Well, the classic one, I think, is planking, which is, if you can imagine, someone lying down on their stomach, especially on like a kind of difficult to lie down on surface, and they straighten themselves like a plank, and it's called planking. And so the other thing about memes is that they try to emphasize, even though we think of them as digital, and that's the origin of the kind of internet meme culture, so many of them are performative. They involve the physical body and people performing an action or a movement. And so in the context of protest, this could take the form of, for instance, when we were talking about Black Lives Matter, right? The hashtag hands up, don't shoot was a performance. It was something that people did on the streets and took the same kind of form, which is people taking pictures, doing an action, and then sharing that online.
What's so interesting, I think the first people to really perform that in a very deliberate way were students at Howard University.
Yeah, that's right. That was certainly one of the more visible ones, was when they, it was such a striking moment when they gathered and all took pictures with their hands up and then posted that online. And that was a leap from Ferguson to the most prestigious historically black college in the United States. And so it was a signal. We are part of this. We are with you. And we are also joining in this action. And so that performative meme, whether you're planking or whether you're engaging in protest, is a way of building community.
What differentiates the memes that spread like wildfire from the ones that die on the vine?
Oh, goodness. It is so hard to know ahead of time which ones will take off and which ones won't. Amanda Lotz is a meme scholar, a media scholar, and she's written about this concept of intentional overproduction. And basically what this means is that if you think about when you look, watch memes, you see people creating things, remixing things, and there's all kinds of iterations. It's difficult to know which one is going to take off. And so deliberately, people will just make as many as possible. And I think of this as like throwing spaghetti on the wall and seeing which ones stick. And so really skilled meme makers know how to intentionally overproduce. On the other hand, there are some characteristics that you can look at after the fact. Strong emotion, a strong identity, appeals to identity, to narrative. There's a misconception that memes are ephemeral, but actually a lot of them kind of hold to a longer, like larger media narrative or national narrative. And then also just a strong visual element. They are interesting or they're unique or novel. And it's this kind of mix that, again, it's much easier to do in retrospect. But the skilled meme makers that I met they know that the secret formula is to really produce as much as you can and then see and then kind of piggyback on existing kind of meme discourse and then see what takes off.
I think one fascinating facet of memes' ability to be quickly changed to suit the needs of different users is the Spain versus Uganda cultural battle. Talk a little bit about how that played out.
Yeah, absolutely. So it was interesting. So it was 2012, and it was the same year as hashtag Kony 2012 took off from the United States. But a few months later, you had the Prime Minister of Spain it was during kind of the one of the economic crises that was hitting Europe and kind of a precursor to the larger economic crises in the region. And the Prime Minister of Spain said, texted his finance minister and said, basically said, don't worry, it will be okay. Spain is not Uganda. And as word of that messaging got out, Ugandans, led by a journalist, Rosebel Kagamire, tweeted back and created a hashtag, Uganda is not Spain, and started tweeting facts and figures about, the growth, GDP growth, and also like kind of the natural landscape and tried to shift the narrative, right? This is a remarkable moment where a developing world country, a country that I think many Westerners would have difficulty spotting on a map, was able to speak back and help reshape a narrative. And it drove some media stories from BBC, Al Jazeera, that looked into, well, what is the difference between Spain and Uganda? What is this story? And so it's a remarkable moment of shifting a narrative, shifting a story.
I think what captures the imagination there is the idea that absolutely, Uganda wanted to get a burn in with Spain and sort of stand up for itself. But I imagine that in Uganda, the production of memes to sort of get back at Spain must have caused a feeling of kind of national pride or at least a coalescence of people who felt national pride in being Ugandan.
I think that's right. Yeah, and I spent 3 months there, and as I talked to people about meme culture, and also just generally how Ugandan youth are getting more online, shaping media, developing apps for their context, it is part of this larger story of a very young country. Literally, it's a lot of people who are under 30 who are coming of age, there's a lot of pride that they express through that hashtag, and then has spread through into other forms of kind of technological media expression.
Is there anything like a lingua franca or a set of linguas franca for internet culture that sort of spreads throughout the world?
It's really hard. It's really hard. And the reason for this is that so much of memes actually speak to international culture itself. And so, we thought that cats took over the internet and that cats were like endemic to the internet. But as soon as you start traveling to rural areas, the fact that there are not a lot of cats just in that society means that You know, again, going back to the goats, goat memes are a lot more popular. So even a simple thing like that is difficult to translate across cultures. And in some places that we looked with researchers, like places like Syria and Iran, the researchers said that the animal memes are not super popular. So even the concept of an animal meme is not the big thing. But there is one interesting aspect, which is Christina Shi has written about this in the context of China, which is rage faces, these kind of crudely drawn faces that are used to express emotion, and an emoji. And emoji are kind of mimetic, but they're also, you know, they're also a keyboard. You know, they're also things that you can type. They're controlled by the Unicode Commission. But it seems that, like, kind of facial expressions and selfies seem to have a common role. And I think if you think about the kind of basics of humanity, right, we think of how, you know, we express ourselves through our faces and then by extension through maybe drawn faces, emoji, et cetera. But otherwise, it's very hard to find a common, you know, common digital visual language, which I think is what makes it interesting.
You compare hashtag trends to a form of digital public assembly. What do you mean by that? Does following and producing a hashtag on something that I create make me part of a larger group automatically?
In some ways, it does. And I started thinking about that in the context of China, first of all, because you don't have that. In mainland China, people don't have that right for public assembly in the same way that I think we're used to in the United States. And so a lot of times when people were speaking out about whether it's police abuses or pollution, they would often use hashtags. And this just became a way to show collectivity, to show that there are a lot of people concerned about an issue. And so it was through the hashtags that people then said, here we are as a community. In the U.S. context, I often think of it as complemented by the physical gatherings. And so when you jump into a hashtag and you are saying that you are part of the hashtag, and this is different, I think, from hashtag co-optation. I think hashtags can also be co-opted. But setting that aside, the act of standing on the hashtag becomes a community signal. It says, okay, this is me. This is what I believe. This is what I stand for. And then the fact that hashtags are then written and on physical signs is in many ways to me an indicator of their role in community building and community identity.
So Tim Wu argued that technology doesn't follow culture so much as culture follows technology, which is to say that technology shaped the way we respond to things. Should we worry on about the fact that what feels like an organic expression of ideas is to a great extent shaped by the media we're given to express those ideas?
I think we should be critically evaluating our digital spaces. In the book, I talk about this concept of like a digital plaza. If you travel to different public spaces, whether it's the National Mall, Tiananmen Square, the Zocalo in Mexico City, all of these public spaces have different politics. You have different rights, different modes of expression. And so I think of memes as like internet street art. They're a way of negotiating media in different kind of physical digital environments. But then those digital environments themselves have a politics. And so I think Tim was right. I think his wonderful book, Attention Merchants, gets to this, that so many of our digital spaces are optimized for advertising, for emotion, and for attention. And so when movements, when journalists, when advertisers are spreading memes, they're optimizing for what is the dominant form of expression that platforms optimize for. And so we thought, you know, there's this rhetoric that the internet was democratizing expression, but so many of the platforms don't have what we think of as the hallmarks of democracy: accountability, transparency, fair representation, mechanisms for deliberative discourse, and instead are very much optimized for attention and advertising.
This is Think. I'm Chris Boyd. So as we've discussed, people are trying to bypass government surveillance and interference in some places. Of course, it was only a matter of time before repressive governments and other challenging entities learned how to do this as well. How good are propagandists at memes?
I think very effective. If you take the Chinese use case, The fact that the government controls the infrastructure as well means that they can censor messages. But then the missing piece in the censorship puzzle is the fact that the government also hires paid commentators who can make a lot of posts. They, Gary King and other researchers at Harvard have looked at this as most of the messages that, appear to come from government commentators are shaping nationalist narratives. And so it's a form, they think of this as a form of distraction from political issues. And so it becomes a way to shape discourse. Yeah, interestingly, the a lot of the kind of the way that the president Xi Jinping spreads, you know, kind of he's projecting himself into digital space is through viral videos, whether it's rap songs or video game style videos. It is an embrace of kind of viral video culture as a way to say, you know, to shape national discourse.
We now understand in the U.S. that Russian trolls went online to stir up partisan outrage among different groups of Americans, especially in the lead up to the 2016 election. Sometimes that outrage led to offline gatherings and activities in the real world.
Yes.
Should we question, do we need to hunt down the source of memes that inspire us to act in real life?
I think we need to bring a criticality to all kinds of media that influence us. And so I think the Russian case is part of a larger story, is that memes are not, you know, what I love about going back to Amanda Brandon's definition is that they spread from person to person. People are sharing them. People are spreading them. And so moving away from the discourse that things just magically go viral is to remember that memes come from somewhere. They come from a context. They have motivations. We need to bring that same criticality that we bring to books, to videos, to film, to journalism, and bring that to meme culture, because it does shape and influence how we act, whether that's Russians or whether that's a movement. So I think that the larger puzzle and the larger thing is what are the new forms of literacy that we need for a digital environment where messages can come from anywhere and with people with different motivations.
There's a complicated psychology at work here, because I might share something that I saw on your Twitter feed because I know you and I trust you, but it didn't necessarily come from you. And yet in my mind, I'm going to associate you with that content.
Yeah, that's right. That's right. And in so many ways, you know, when you think about how content messages spread online, you know, you had the traditional mechanisms of journalism and editorial review that in the broadcast era that had these kind of internal checks. In a networked environment, in a world where all of us can become our own kind of mini nodes, our own kind of mini media nodes, we also need to start developing these kind of same sorts of editorial judgments, the same understanding of how messages might resonate across an audience, and so many ways that looks like some of the struggles that people had with the original kind of television and radio challenges was, how do you evaluate this? What are the responsibilities and ethics? And right now, I do think we are in this time of thinking what are the ethics of expression online, and how do we engage responsibly while also keeping a lot of the joy that brought us to the internet in the first place.
My guest is artist, researcher, and technologist Anshau Mina. We're talking about her book, Memes to Movements: How the World's Most Viral Media is Changing Social Protest and Power. You can join us at 1-800-933-5372 or find us on Twitter at KERA Think. This is Think. I'm Chris Boyd, speaking with technologist, researcher, and artist Anshau Mina. Her book is Memes to Movements: How the World's Most Viral Media is Changing Social Protest and Power. You can join us at 800-933-5372. With regard to social protest and power, you point out something here that I hadn't given any thought to, and I'm really glad to have been made aware of it, and that is the tendency of Western media to name things what it wants to name things, whether or not that name actually reflects the movement itself. So the name Umbrella Revolution versus Umbrella Movement, even if nobody had malicious intentions, they're different things.
They are different things, yeah. And I think the original narrative, right, from the West was this is an umbrella revolution. It certainly sounds very interesting, right? It harkens back to the color revolutions during the Soviet era. But it, you know, as movement organizers and a lot of folks on the ground were, you know, finding this was, it was not meant to be a revolution. It was a movement. It was a movement for more suffrage, for universal suffrage, but was not meant to topple the government. And in fact, the framing of revolution, many folks thought was very dangerous because it might, you know, might trigger greater ire from the powers that be. And so, you know, whether that's Uganda is not Spain or hashtag umbrella movement, I think it's interesting how memes can be used to kind of reshape discourse and reshape kind of international narratives as well.
It's also interesting to consider how much time news organizations that are really sort of set up for different platforms now spend trying to keep up with internet memes and report on them independently.
Yes, yeah. Yeah, it's super interesting. And in so many ways, news organizations are also kind of, you know, one, well, they, you know, it's people, we're all networked beings, people, those of us on the internet, so are influenced and shaped by digital culture. Many journalists are spending their time on Twitter. Many journalistic outlets depend on the attention economy as well, on advertising. And so meme culture is, it's part of larger culture. It spreads misinformation. It helps shape movements, narratives, and is a really important part of culture and discourse. And so the fact that journalists are spending time with it is I think encouraging. And then at the same time, I think journalists have to, you know, we all have to engage with this in interesting and critical ways. And I think we're all kind of developing those muscles, and it's an interesting time to be doing journalism.
All right, let's go to the phones now. 800-933-5372 is our number. Jessica is calling from Waco. Hi, Jessica.
Hi, I was just wondering, I don't know much about how France and their memes went, and I wondered if you did any research on how possibly that they did a lot of memes and then they became not good enough. And from that came possibly the Yellow Vest movement, because I know as Americans, we seem to be on the cusp of our own Yellow Vest movement, because memes aren't doing any good, and we feel like a lot of marginalized people, especially with the government shutdown, are being just ignored.
What do you think about that, An?
Yeah, I wish I could speak more specifically to France and the Yellow Vest movement. What's interesting is watching how it's spreading, that it is spreading to the UK. It is apparently spreading through much of Europe as a symbol. And I think there's a deeper point here that I think you're making, Jessica, which is around how marginalized communities have to, you know, to gain attention, to shape national narratives, to bring their voices to the table, are often using and turning to meme culture, and in different ways. What's interesting about the Yellow Vest movement is that it is both physical and digital, which I think is something we should expect from all movements moving forward. And the dominant frame that I think about when I'm asking questions about a meme's effectiveness is how much does it, one, get attention to an issue that people feel is being ignored or dismissed, and then two, how is it then shaping a narrative? What is the new story it is telling about that community? And so, again, not being able to speak to specifics, but those are the sorts of questions I would ask. And then, in what way are people learning from each other and learning these same techniques? And so, how much will the United States iteration of this, well, what will it look like? I think is will depend a lot on how this plays out in France too.
Memes don't always start as memes and then move into the physical world. You write about the really incredibly effective meme of the red Make America Great Again hats that have sort of launched 1,000 MAGA hashtags.
That's right. That's right. Yeah. So that's an example of, well, one, it is a reference, of course, to Reagan's slogan, "Let's make America great again." And, you know, take out the L, you have a much more pronounceable hashtag. And then through selfie culture, through digital remix, it then became a digital meme. And of course, then faced remix culture and meme culture. And so in New York, there's an activist named Jeronimo Saldana who created Make America Mexico Again, and he was riffing off of a digital meme that was floating around. And so the hats, even the physical hats themselves, became remixed. And so it really is what something we should expect more and more of, this interplay between the physical object being remixed, the kind of physical performance of wearing it, and then sharing it online, and then that remix going back and forth.
As a scholar, this is all changing so quickly and evolving with such extraordinary
Oh, goodness.
speed.
Yes.
Um, How concerned are you about the potential of people who follow you decades from now to even understand the nuances of a moment like ours?
Yeah, it is very tough. And in the book, I finished the manuscript a year and a half ago. So it was, I knew that meme culture would be different, especially in politics, by the time the book came out. And so I try to focus on one is using case studies, looking at very specific examples. But two, as a result, is then trying to provide frameworks. What are the questions we want to bring to the table? What are the ways that we can think about memes? And then how can we think about them historically, even before the internet, and how kind of remix culture has long been a part of kind of movement symbology and narratives. And so one hope that I have for the book is that it can help us ask those questions so that inevitably when we have new things like the Yellow Vest movement, we can bring these kind of questions and frameworks to it that can help us kind of figure out what is happening, how they're being used, and the potential impact they have.
You talked about, I think the phrase you used was overproduction of culture, overproduction of like potential memes. You know, you throw a bunch of spaghetti on the fridge and you see what sticks.
Mm-hmm.
Is the preponderance of memes out there going to ultimately dilute the impact of even the very strongest among them?
I think there's a risk there. There's a risk of systemic overload, that there's just too much media out there. There's too much out there to make sense of, and that exhausts us, right? And that's kind of one of the new forms of disinformation and digital propaganda, is to just spread too many narratives, too many stories that we can't make sense of what's going on anymore. And so that's absolutely a risk of this moment. And I think it's important to recognize that it's part of a larger trend. The number of television channels, the number of radio shows, the number of newspapers, the amount of media that's out there can seem overwhelming. And so, again, this goes back to kind of developing those defenses, those ways of looking through media, of understanding it, critically evaluating it. I do think we need people can curate content more effectively in a networked way, in ways that make sense for different people and different audiences. But this is going to be a challenge moving forward. And I think the first step is to recognize it and then to then figure out, okay, given this context, how can we help people make sense of the world and kind of bring a different sort of criticality to all the types of media that we have access to.
I recognize that people of all ages engage in really meaningful ways online these days, but I wonder if there is any kind of generation gap to the extent that there are new media platforms being created all the time, and
yes,
it can be hard for older folks to keep up. And by older folks, I include myself in my late 40s. You know, my kids are much more aware of what's new than I am.
You know, it's so funny. I'm writing this book about memes, right? And I feel so old lately. There's this new platform, TikTok, right? And it's all about short videos with music. And I'm watching it. I don't get these jokes. What the heck is going on? In addition to the kind of media, it's also the platforms. There's always something new, and it's very difficult to keep up. There is these kind of micro generations. The TikTok folks are different from the Snapchat folks, and the Snapchat folks are different from the Instagram folks. It can be difficult to keep up. And I think it goes back to its kind of basics around research, that as kind of someone who looks at this stuff, is to, you have to go back to sitting down, talking to people, asking questions and saying, what the heck is going on with this video? I think that's what makes it exciting. But yeah, absolutely. It's hard to follow all the major trends.
My guest is technologist, researcher and artist Anshau Mina. You're listening to Think. I'm Chris Boyd. I would imagine it's really frustrating to create a meme or a piece of content and put it out there with a particular intention and then have it get hijacked into someone else's meme. Have you talked to people who've been in that situation and how do they, I don't know if you can fight back against that.
It is very hard. The kind of riffs and remixes of hashtag culture, especially, means that the message you get out there, the meme you get out there, can be co-opted. It can be recontextualized and then turned into a different type of meme. And so I think that, you know, there's on the one hand, there's not much you can do once it has been taken over, and I think especially you know, when I'm looking in places like China, places like Uganda, where people are trying to kind of riff against government narratives, the new techniques is to just, you know, riff on that narrative and to co-opt it. But on the other hand, the techniques that a lot of folks will tell me is that, in addition to, you know, counter narratives are inherently a little weak. They are just telling, you know, they're countering the story, and so the way that a lot of mimetic movements think about things is how do you tell the new story? What is the new narrative? How can you shape discourse? And recognizing at the same time that inevitably the things you put online will be remixed in for many different reasons. But if you can shape the narrative, build that community, it can be discouraging in the moment. But a lot of folks will say, well, over time, you know, with access to media, with access to broader communities, you can shape the larger vision. And that's what a lot of folks will talk about.
It may seem like a strange example, but like the character Pepe the Frog was not created as a symbol of the alt-right. And it seems like he'll never get away from that now.
That's the challenge. That's right. And so the curator Matt Fury has, you know, has really spoken out about this and tried working with the ADL to as the hashtag take back the frog, but its connotations have shifted. But it's interesting is when you look at the listing on the Anti-Defamation League's website, it does recognize that the frog is used as a symbol of hate in certain contexts. And so there's this recognition that even the symbologies are contextual. And the researchers looking at how the frog is spread in China, and it is just a sad frog. And so that meaning, that context shifts depending on where you are, your intentions. And so over time, its meaning might change again.
So people create memes just to make a comment or to delight other people. Sometimes they create memes as a form of political expression, even an expression of political dissidence. Does it bother you the preponderance of people are putting content out there like hoping to become internet influencers, sort of thinking about their own fame more than anything deeper?
Well, it's tricky, right? Because some people are thinking about their fame, and we live, you know, in the U.S., we live in this kind of micro celebrity culture. On the other hand, that is not a universal experience. Around the world, sometimes people are just spreading messages because they want to get the message out, or they're thinking more collectively about how they want to support the movement. And so we do live in this culture. We do live with systems that kind of promote personality. That is not necessarily a bad thing. That can be used to spread messages. That can be used to build community. Like with everything, though, you know, bringing that criticality and asking, are these folks motivated largely by being famous, or are they using that fame? And that kind of relational ability, right? It's a social relationship in so many ways to help influence discourse, and it's kind of case by case. But I'm not discouraged, because I think I've seen a lot of wonderful examples of people using that ability to project relationships, to direct what are called parasocial relationships, for positive ends as well.
Just quickly before I let you go, what does it look like for you to monitor this culture every day? How much time do you have to spend on social media?
You know, lately it has been every day there is a new meme that hits the headlines.
Wow.
And so it is, you know, just yesterday, right, the hamburger pictures from Trump. A few days before that was the Ocasio-Cortez dancing videos.
Right.
It is a constant stream of things. And so it is hard for me to keep up. I will heart things. I will hold on to things that I want to look at. But in some ways, the reason I write about these frameworks is that it can help many people, not just me, keep up with what's going on and ask questions about them.
Anshel Mina is a technologist, researcher, and artist. She's author of the book Memes to Movements, How the World's Most Viral Media is Changing Social Protest and Power. It's been really interesting. Thanks very much for making time for us.
Thanks so much for having me here, Chris.
You can follow us on Facebook and on Twitter. Our Twitter handle is at KERA Think. Use your favorite podcast app or your smart speaker to be a listener to the Think podcast. Learn what we have on the show coming up at our website, think.kera.org. Again, I'm Chris Boyd. Thanks for listening. Have a great day.